Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 88 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 967. All right. After that lengthy discussion of the general nature of cults, and specifically a lot about the need for and the physics of a new cult that would be based on the faith of Jesus, and you know how that would be formed sometime in the future. We're back to more burrowing in on the details of, the general timeline of the evolution of religion. We keep doing sweeps, so, just sort of rough sweeps across the majority of that span of time. Each Passover, we consider another element a little, that we just brushed, briefly over before. And, so next up is in that process of zeroing in more precisely and kind of going all the way back to the beginning again, is this issue of fetishes. That's the primary, concept in play here, not just talking about worshiping whatever, like we did in the first paper of this block, but getting into the details of what sort of a concept humans have had, and once they originated this fetish concept, how. As we have seen over and over again, things start out very simple and literal because that's the only thing a primitive human can do. But as humans mature, get a little more sophisticated, there's a natural tendency to take that concept and use it in ever more abstract ways. Until you'll see as we get into this, you're using it in ways that are kind of surprisingly abstract, and especially for a relatively primitive human. But because of that, there's a long tradition of, once it gets quite abstract, it's much more easy to flip it into more of a metaphoric sort of a usage. And so we have, there's a lot of kind of general ways that we speak about things, think about things, all the way up to today, that has its roots in a very direct, literal concept of a fetish. So it's an important element to focus on. And you'll see that in the process, we're also going to speak a little bit more directly about just the concept of magic involved in religious thinking. We've certainly brought that up over and over, in passing. But it's a concept that we want to focus on a little bit more precisely also. All right, so we've got a couple of little paragraphs here for a preface. Let's see how they launch us on this new subject.
Paper 88, Fetishes, Charms, and Magic. The concept of a spirit's entering into an inanimate object, an animal, or a human being, is a very ancient and honorable belief, having prevailed since the beginning of the evolution of religion. This doctrine of spirit possession is nothing more nor less than fetishism. The savage does not necessarily worship the fetish. He very logically worships and reverences the spirit resident therein.
Okay, so you can see in the process of introducing it, italicizing the word fetishism, and they're giving you a basic definition. If you had some confusion about that, because after all, for most people in the Western world, it's been a long time since we took fetishes literally. Like what they're talking about here, you know, literal possession of of some object, animate or inanimate, the literal possession by a spirit being. Okay, now, in the midst of that basic sort of introduction to the concept of a fetish, so everyone is on the correct page here before we start, you probably noticed an interesting word that they tossed out in there. Yeah, it's a very ancient, but what? An honorable belief? They're obviously wanting you to pull back on the reins in this very first paragraph by using that word and get your reflective juices going before you read any further. Why did they say that? Why is it an honorable belief? Well, I mean, it seems, at least in part, that they sort of answer that question at the end of the paragraph to some degree. The savage does not necessarily worship the fetish. Now, the fact that it's maybe not totally answering it, you're thinking, is it doesn't say, it says, it doesn't say the savage does not worship the fetish. It says the savage does not necessarily. Okay. So you're wondering about, well, is it too strong a thing to say honorable? Okay. But anyway, the savage does not necessarily worship the fetish. He very logically, the very fact that they say logically, there's some honor in that. Even if, in some bigger sense, it's a false logic, it's still a logic. The humans are still attempting to use their spiritualized mind in a holistic way. Right? That the logic, rather than merely reason, is implying it's being used in a holistic way. So he very logically worships and reverences the spirit resident therein. So it seems like, okay, well, there's obviously some honor, in his care not to be silly about what he's thinking and doing. Just a little aside, notice how they say worships and reverences. Kind of, again, reminds you how we're going back to the first paper, like I said, about, quote-unquote, worship, and how we said that fundamentally you have reverence from the, that's there, that feeling is there because of the sixth adjutant. And, if we don't just use the word worship as a synonym for reverence, it's like, well, maybe we use it as a synonym for veneration. So you could be thinking, well, did they kind of mean adding veneration on top of that basic kind of more amorphous reverence? But then there's also, we'll use the word worship if we want to suggest that there's some literal ritual involved too. Yeah. So it you can kind of decide how you want to parse their usage there, but obviously you, in any conscious way, we're not talking about genuine worship here. We're talking about a very primitive phenomenon. But nonetheless, just giving you a little sense of a foundation and building upon that foundation of reverence. Okay, but let's step fully back from the paragraph. And, because it's very definitive. It is a very ancient and honorable belief, right? There's no qualifier. So, if I really can't satisfy my curiosity about the use of the word honorable by thinking in a factual mode, I probably need to, like I just said, step back further. It's honorable because of the truth of the phenomenon, probably, not some way of precisely parsing it factually. So what would be, there's an essence to the concept of fetishism, they're saying, that has a validity in truth. Okay.
A spirit's entering.
Right. All right, the degree to which you call a thought adjuster a spirit fragment, and it's literally within your mind, in other words, it has to enter your mind. Yeah. See? No matter how silly it might be, you've got a rock with some curious marking on it, and they think that some nature spirit is in it or something, and you're thinking, how could that be honorable? In fact, no. But in truth, right, it's, especially since it goes, from objects to animals and eventually to human beings, right, there's a truth to the essence of the concept of fetishism. That it's moving us toward that recognition. And you might even wonder, do you suppose that to some degree, the fact that there were adjusters in some humans might have actually fed into this inclination to believe in fetishism? Right, especially because, every once in a while, someone genetically... it's usually very problematic, but they have a little bit of an awareness when their adjuster comes. Usually throws them into a tailspin of all sorts of curious beliefs about themselves. But the degree to which there might even be in some people, and they probably would have ended up being shamans and stuff, right? I think I actually experienced it when I was about 6, a spirit entering me. Maybe that didn't originate fetishism, but if they had the concept of fetishism and they're already thinking about spirits entering, he could have easily interpreted his experience that way.
Even the concept of spirit.
Yeah.
Even is above the animal concept, in terms of.
Right. Yep.
So there has to be something there. Yeah.
So anyway, you see, that's what they're trying to get you to think about. That this isn't, this isn't just, who cares about fetishes, charms, and magic? Let's skip to the next paper. They're right in the very first paragraph. They're wanting to see if they can get you to not be so simple-minded, about things. And be curious about reflecting on yet another predicate to a genuine reality of our nature that has curious, kind of fuzzy, groping beginnings to it. But nonetheless, coincidentally, quote-unquote, is there. So a fifth epical revelation can directly talk about thought adjusters, and there's an evolutionary predicate for such a thought. It isn't completely bizarre. Well, no one has ever considered anything like a spirit entering something. That's just too weird. See, so the eventual revelation about thought adjusters can be given in an evolutional fashion. Because coincidentally, there's fetishism, the fetishism concept is a predicate to it. Everything, just more and more think, well, is there anything that humans think that is really genuinely original, or is this all just a vast conspiracy of coincidentally humans will think this and do this and whatnot? Yeah. In many ways, right, we aren't fonts of originality. We aren't that personal. We're material-minded selves in a cosmic system that is all one whole and has no coincidences in its supremacy. And so it's impossible for any world to not have the evolutionary predicates for subsequent revelation. They always coincidentally will, because it's all one vast conspiratorial, if you will, scheme. Right? There's a wholeness to the parts. The whole is the quote-unquote conspiracy I'm referring to, right? It isn't just a bunch of random, you know, functioning parts. They all exist in the context of a whole and are fundamentally subject to its wholeness.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, you get the sense that celestials marvel at the variations of it.
Yeah.
But the fundamentals of it, it's kind of really solid.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, after millions of examples, you know, they just know now, okay, I can't even remotely guess how it's going to come to pass on this world, but I know it's going to. Because it can't do anything else, right? And see, we humans need to have more of that. There's nothing really to fear. It doesn't matter how disruptive something might appear to be. You know, it isn't somehow a phenomenon that ripped us out of the hole and now we're adrift. Right? You can't get out of the hole. The hole will always have its will. And its way.
Get out of the sheltered bay. Out of the hole.
It all will come to pass. And
there's only one way out of the hole. Day of choice.
Yeah. Yep.
In fact, you're going to set that up for yourself.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like
that would have been a good one.
No, but like he's saying, like I point out, all you know, the only way to get out of the influence of the whole is to go to iniquity. But it's a technicality because what gets out of the whole is nothing.
Right.
Right. There, something can't exist outside of the whole. So the only way to separate yourself from the influence of the whole is to become nothing. Yeah. Right? That's the only way.
By choice.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Iniquities by choice.
Yeah. All right. What's the other little tidbit they toss out here in the preface?
At first, the spirit of a fetish was believed to be the ghost of a dead man. Later on, the higher spirits were supposed to reside in fetishes. And so the fetish cult eventually incorporated all of the primitive ideas of ghosts, souls, spirits, and demon possession.
Okay, so again, they're reminding us of that we have this hierarchical thing that develops with the evolutionary process. You know, we start with the concept that humans have a quote-unquote soul of some sort, some not matter, you know, not body part to you, some immaterial part. And then when that departs, you know, that quote-unquote soul, whatever you imagine it is, becomes a quote-unquote ghost. And then eventually you conceive of those ghosts moving up a hierarchy and becoming quote-unquote spirits. And then, you know, that last little thing about demon possession, you know, that reminds you, oh, well, there is another fact that is definitely going to reinforce some belief in fetishism. Because there really were rebel secondary midwares, you know, literally possessing, like, say, an animal.
But not that far back. They didn't really happen until...
Well, yeah, but I mean, yeah, I mean, not in the... It doesn't give the... Demon possession is not the origin of fetishism. But see, it reinforces it.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, it means that fetishism would have a tendency to go closer to now, you know, than it might have naturally. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, try to convince, you know, a basic Christian that there isn't demon possession.
Impossible.
Right, it's impossible. They know there's demon possession because it says so in the Bible, and it's like, well, yeah. 2,000 years ago, there literally was. Okay. All right. So anyway, see, they're just, you can see what they're doing there with that, the two preface paragraphs here. They're just trying to get you to think about this basic concept and what would have given origin to it, what would have reinforced it, you know. And so, you know, now they're ready to, it's like, well, okay. Let's look at the details a little bit. What things have we done along this line of, you know, like I said at the end of the the session last week. You know, not just say worshiping a hill, quote unquote, or a mountain, but thinking of the mountain in a fetishistic way. Right? That's what we're wanting to get at. Not everything is a fetish, but you're having this evolution that if you're going to, quote unquote, worship it, you're going to think, you're not just going to think of it as a material object that you fancy, but you're going to think of it as a fetish, and you're going to worship the spirit within the object. See, so you're adding that complexity. Okay, let's look at see what they give us for some details here.
Section 1, belief in fetishes. Primitive man always wanted to make anything extraordinary into a fetish. Chance, therefore, gave origin to many. A man is sick, something happens, and he gets well. The same thing is true of the reputation of many medicines and the chance methods of treating disease. Objects connected with dreams were likely to be converted into fetishes. Volcanoes, but not mountains, became fetishes. Comets, but not stars. Early man regarded shooting stars and meteors as indicating the arrival on Earth of special visiting spirits.
Okay, so see, so in this first paragraph, they're getting you, giving you the, pardon the pun, the spirit of this. Of this concept, right? See, the very fact that I say the spirit of something is because of fetishism, right? See, that's part of our language. So you've got this basic assumption that life naturally is a drone tone. And anything besides the drone tone is being explained, understood, as being the result of spirit action. Okay? Anything extraordinary. You know, and so, you know, like they're saying at the beginning there, all of the coincidental things, you know, that also leads to why you believe that certain things are medicinal or whatever, like they're saying, you know, it, just coincidentally two things are happen to be at the same place at the same time and you causally link them because by grace, you're encircled in the Holy Spirit. You have a first cosmic intuition, and you just want to label something causal, and you do, even if it's not valid.
Sometimes it is valid.
Sometimes it is, of course. But so it starts out. There's lots and lots of things like that that end up becoming fetishes because they just happen to be co-located. Okay. And something fancy happened. It's like, oh, it must be that object there, and there must be a spirit in it. And then, you know, we've already talked about how the very fact that you're basing ghost land, spirit land on dreamland, you know, is going to lead to what they're, you know, pointing out there, that objects connected with dreams were likely to be converted into fetishes. You know, because that's the whole concept. I'm literally seeing ghosts in my dream. You know, everything has to quote unquote be a ghost. But there's this tendency to not think in simplistic fashion that the rock in the dream itself is a ghost, which is the way they would have started thinking about it. And there's no difference between me and a rock, right? But to start to think in this fancier fashion, that the rock got in the dream because there's a spirit, you know, in a rock, and that's why a rock can be in a dream. Now, obviously, they're not going to be very consistent about this, you know, and remind themselves, well, there were a lot of things in that dream. It's just going to be the fancy thing in the dream that caught their attention, you know, that will then get this treatment of becoming a fetish. See, and then, like, you know, like I was saying, you don't just worship hills now or mountains in general, but you're looking for this extraordinary thing. You're looking for, normally it's like just sitting there, drone tone, and then something changes. All changes are due to spirit action, right? So there's the boring mountains that just sit there. They're not going to be fetishes. But the volcanoes, okay, obviously there's a spirit in that mountain. Let's call him Yahweh. Right? Or, you know, stars, they're just sitting there, run-of-the-mill star. But when you see this fancy thing, like a comet or, you know, meteors, right, so those objects are going to become fetishes because of their differential from the drone tone. And again, just the basic, again, pardon the pun, spirit of that way of thinking, that more and more there's this tendency to not just take whatever and falsely elevate it. But more and more you have the sense that this notion of spirit has got to be reserved for the most fancy. Like I often say, I mean, for most people, even today, they use the word spirit to indicate extraordinary mind, fancy mind. Now, ordinary mind, no, it's not spirit. But anytime their mind is in some extraordinary state, they speak of that as a spiritual state. So we're still in that fetishistic mode in the way humans use the word spirit. It's just, no one has gone all the way and say, it's not just plain old mind. It's not fancy mind. It's not mind at all. Okay, no one has taken that full step. We're still in this extraordinary is the spirit. Yep.
They're not entirely illogical, though, because when they're thinking of an animated spirit, not just spirit substance, but they're attributing a person there. Are they not?
Yes.
A person has mind associated with it.
I'm glad you brought that up. I maybe should have mentioned that when we were talking about the preface. Do remember that technically with fetishism, unlike with the thought adjuster, they're literally thinking of a being, a spirit being, possessing the rock or animal or whatever, not just an entity like the thought adjuster, but something that has a personality, it's a being. It has purposes, right, to it, not just a functioning. Okay, so, and again, see that, like I said, the very fact that beings, secondary midwares, did possess reinforces that assumption. This is the full-on being thing possessing. This isn't just some, spirit influence or even entity or something. This is literal possession. Okay. That's obviously going to be an issue. But on the flip side, at least Yahweh is a personal God then. That thing they're worshiping that's possessing the mountain. He's not just an amorphous, Brahmin or something. Okay. So it has, it has its positive side. It gets you thinking towards a personal God. You just need to eventually abstract Yahweh from the mountain. Okay.
The first fetishes were peculiarly marked pebbles and sacred stones have ever since been sought by man. A string of beads was once a collection of sacred stones, a battery of charms. Many tribes had fetish stones, but few have survived as have the Kaaba and the Stone of Scone. Fire and water were also among the early fetishes, and fire worship, together with belief in holy water, still survives.
Okay. So, you know, notice the main thing that they're adding in, this whole bit of thinking of fetishes is what brings in some object being quote-unquote sacred. That's where that modifier, it's a sacred book or whatever. That's all based upon fetishism, right? If you are inclined to think of this book in my lap, the Urantia book, as a sacred text, as a sacred book, that's because you're in the old wineskin of fetishism. You know, and of course they love to throw in little tidbits like strings of beads. It's like, oh, that's the whole battery of charms thing is what you know really got that concept. You know, it wasn't just adornment. Okay. Yeah. I was going to get that in a second. But your comment in passing there, right? The thing that you should think of is not so much, just a pearl necklace, say, or something. Okay, but like rosary beads. Yeah, those are, or any other religion's beads. Right. See, that's again fetishism. It may be there may be great effort to not think of it literally fetishistically, and to think of it just symbolically, as a reminder for whatever. But the intense identification that humans have with such notions is because of the naturalness of fetishism. They want to have, say, rosary beads because their desire to have fetishes, and they just superimpose a more sophisticated, interpretation upon themselves. And, in other words, everyone kind of just fools themselves, that this is why I'm doing this. But really why we're doing it is our desire to believe in fetishes, the power of fetishes. Now, so they mention a couple of famous stones. You've got the famous one in Mecca. Mm-hmm. You remember Kaaba means cube, right? That cubic black cubicle building, right? The literal Kaaba building, right? There's this stone stuck on there, in a frame on the outside, the Kaaba stone, the black stone. That's one of those fetish stones that Muhammad is, in founding Islam, he's thinking in evolutionary terms. He's not just going to force them to reject the sacred stone. He's gonna work that in as a little footnote to the new religion. And then the stone of Scone, for a long, long time, that was Scotland's coronation stone. And all the kings of Scotland were crowned on that coronation stone, until the beginning of the Renaissance when Edward I made off with it and put it in Westminster Abbey, and it became the coronation stone for the English. Yeah, but eventually it became the coronation stone for the British. It is now kept back in Scotland, but hasn't been used for a long time because Queen Elizabeth II's been around for a while. But once there's a new person to replace Queen Elizabeth II, whoever that might be, they'll haul that coronation stone back from Edinburgh to Westminster Abbey, and that person will be, you know, crowned upon the stone of Scone. Because again, you're, you know, the belief, you know, you can just think about what the divine right concept of kings, right? You are literally absorbing that spirit energization into the king or queen as they are crowned upon that fetish stone.
Yeah. Right, and the next new one is called the Trump Tower. Sorry, I could resist.
But, you know, it's just this literal stone with, it's got hooks, you know, in it because it's heavy, so you can move it around. And so it has all this utility to it, but it's also a magical object. Okay.
So it's a Kaaba stone, a stone that's actually in that huge wall, or is the whole wall a Kaaba stone?
No, there's just on one corner, there's a little frame with a stone in it.
Huh?
No, it's not that big. You know, and the, you know, the concept is, you know, I mean, there's a lot of history, okay, to the Kaaba stone, but you know, just to kind of the simplistic thought is, you know, it's a meteorite, or was at some point way back in the past, you know, it's that, like they were just talking about, right? It fell from heaven, it's of heaven, it's, you know, inspirited, and, right, you know, it's a sacred stone. You know, and you still have people, primitive peoples, you know, worshiping meteorites. Okay, then the other thing, fire and water, you know, remember, we're coming back to these things we've talked about many times in different contexts, but now thinking about fire and water, not as just some fancy woo-woo stuff, but in a literal sense that they're a fetish, that there's a spirit in the fire, or there's a spirit in the water. And of course, holy water, you know, remember we just read a little bit ago, it's made holy by the priests washing their feet in it. So think about the physics that people have in their head. The priest puts his feet in the water to wash the dust off of his feet or whatever. And I mean, literally the spirit that's in him goes through his feet into the water. You know, and see, they're not just thinking that this was touched by a special person. Through that person, there's literally a spirit in the water. And so when you throw holy water on some boogeyman, you know, like we love to do in our stories, see, it's not the water, right? You're not that silly. Logically, remember we said logically, you believe that the spirit in the water is attacking the spirit in that person. Not the water is attacking the spirit in that person. You aren't that silly. That's simplistic.
Unless it's Wizard Bond, your bucket of water is okay.
Right, but just, you know, I'm melting, see, you know? I mean, why is she melting? Because the spirit in the water is attacking her. Right? I mean, you know that if that evil spirit is going to be defeated, it can't be defeated by matter. It has to be defeated by spirit. So you have that bit of logic, that consistency. Spirit has to engage spirit. Mm-hmm. See, so even if way in the past you were initially just thinking that the water was magic, right? You're more sophisticated now. It's like, no, water's not magic. There's a spirit in the water, but that's not a magical thought. Right? And the spirit is attacking. All right. Okay, so that's the idea here. And you know, and just notice they've already brought in, you know, the charm thing is just, you know, a little secondary issue. You know, the difference between fetish and charm is just, okay, a charm is a fetish, but you're thinking that fetish is now going to be used to some end. It's bringing in that coercive aspect of the ghost cult, you know, that I can coerce the spirit in the object to do my bidding. I can force its possession of this object to be a charm to my ends. See, so that's the deal of going from fetishes to charms. Is now you're wielding the spirits. So in the same way that you think that prayer coerces the gods and wields God to your ends, that's what's being thought of with the charms again.
It survives in the form of a cereal.
Yeah. Right. And obviously there's going to be a lot of the concept of luck. Maybe the wielding, of the spirit in the fetish object is just to the end of forcing there to be good luck or bad luck in a certain situation. Right. Hence the name of the cereal, Lucky Charms. Yes. Okay.
Tree fetishes were a later development, but among some tribes, the persistence of nature worship led to belief in charms, indwelt by some sort of nature spirit. When plants and fruits became fetishes, they were taboo as food. The apple was among the first to fall into this category. It was never eaten by the Levantine peoples.
Well, let's just do that fun little thought at the end. If you're familiar with, the passage in Genesis, it doesn't literally talk about an apple. It just talks about the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Mm-hmm. But it's been passed on.
But, so why do some cultures represent that fruit as an apple? Well, this is why. I mean, you might think of other rationalizations for it, but they're just pointing out here, no, whatever. Most fundamentally, the apple, is a natural for that role as a forbidden fruit because it is the forbidden fruit of the Levantine peoples. Okay. To bite into an apple is to bite into a spirit, and you're not going to do it. Okay, now notice the other thing they're reminding us. Remember how we talked about this before when you developed the ghost cult? It's like, well, what about the whole nature, more directly nature spirit stuff? Well, that gets, a lot of times that doesn't get totally thrown away. It gets blended in, and the nature spirits take on the lesser roles in the ghost cult. So maybe it isn't this ghost exalted to a spirit possessing, because you start possessing this bauble. I don't know. I'm thinking of spirit as being high, but I need a spirit to possess the bauble. Oh well, I've got the nature spirits. They're kind of right down there with the baubles. Right. See, so it's a natural, quote unquote, logical way to rationalize where the desired sort of commensurate spirit comes from for your bauble. Okay, or for the water even, or the fire. All right, so that's just another example of how humans seldom totally toss out a concept. They always find a new usefulness for some old concept and just keep it going, at least in spirit, pardon the pun. All right.
If an animal ate human flesh, it became a fetish. In this way, the dog came to be the sacred animal of the Parsis. If the fetish is an animal and the ghost is permanently resident therein, then fetishism may impinge on reincarnation. In many ways, the savages envied the animals. They did not feel superior to them and were often named after their favorite beasts.
See, so the interesting thing there is they're pointing out how this line of the fetishism concept that we're following along here doesn't remain isolated. It impinges upon other parallel concepts, and there's mutual reinforcement that goes on. So reincarnation, for instance, you see eventually people going, oh, well, yeah, reincarnation, definitely. And I hadn't thought about that. That's basically what we've been thinking with fetishism anyway. Oh, so fetishism validates reincarnation, and reincarnation validates fetishism, and okay, then they're mutually validated. So there's that concept that gets going. Not to mention why it is that even today humans have a hard time, a lot of humans have a hard time seeing themselves as superior to an animal. There's no difference between me and, you know, insert your favorite animal in the blank, right? Dog, cat, prairie dog, whatever. It's like, well, you know, when I think in fetishistic terms, I mean, if the real profound aspect of an object is the spirit that possesses it, isn't the spirit that's possessing an animal just as profound as the spirit that possesses a human? So is there really a difference between animals and humans? It might appear, right, that there's a difference, but I know that really, fetishistically, they're the same. And again, there's a bit of honorableness to that, because of course we are kindred spirits as humans. No matter how different we are, by grace our encirclement in the Holy Spirit is on equal footing. Okay.
And what's common in a modern person's experience, people are a dime a dozen. They're just overflowing the place. Mm-hmm. But certain animals, they're rare.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be valuable just because of their rarity.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if the rarity is technically due to the fact that humans have killed almost all of them, you know, they don't really think about that. You know, it just becomes rare and it becomes all the fancier. Yeah, so that's the fascinating thing about how all this is within a system, and why it's, again, so difficult for any specific concept to just totally evaporate, because these tentacles, you know, get woven into everything else, and it just becomes you know, so innately woven into the fabric of our whole worldview that it can't go away. Okay? And you can lose all specific sense of such rationalization schemes, but you won't lose the essence of it. That it's fundamental. It's basic to the world in which we live, and that's why we continue to believe in it. It's when we talk like this about the general aspects of what they're speaking of that you're getting into why there's this whole paper giving you all these details about this, that, and the other superstition. Right? I mean, I'm not just pushing on this to belabor these points. If we don't push beyond the immediacy, there's no way that we're going to get some truth relative to studying this. You need to get to the, to move away from the specific to the general, in some sense, in order to get to the truth of it. So it's important to spend some time just reflecting on what's between the lines of these statements they're making. All right, let's keep going.
When animals became fetishes, there ensued the taboos on eating the flesh of the fetish animal. Apes and monkeys, because of resemblance to man, early became fetish animals. Later, snakes, birds, and swine were also similarly regarded. At one time, the cow was a fetish, the milk being taboo, while the excreta were highly esteemed. The serpent was revered in Palestine, especially by the Phoenicians, who, along with the Jews, considered it to be the mouthpiece of evil spirits. Even many moderns believe in the charm powers of reptiles. From Arabia on through India to the snake dance of the Moki tribe of red men, the serpent has been revered.
Okay. So getting a little bit more into the fetishistic animal instead of just the inanimate object. Again, you're reminded, not only of why snakes are in the Old Testament, for instance, but why the whole swine thing in the Old Testament and the New Testament. What's this taboo thing about it? For whatever reason, right, and it may have been, you don't want to find yourself between Mama Pig and her piglets. She won't just kill you, she'll eat you. Okay? And they just pointed out, it could have been something as simple as that swines become fetish animals. You can easily have the notion believed by everyone that demons are cast out of a person and into swine, because swine are natural spirit receptacles. Everyone knows that. Right? We've always believed that. It's not just going to be any old thing. You got something that naturally can take a spirit, and a swine can. That's their belief.
But all those people over there
in Caressa,
right?
Yeah, exactly. That's obviously what I'm talking about. The famous, incident that everyone believed Jesus did, which of course he didn't do. But anyway, right? See, so that, and you notice this whole bit of the extraordinary being fetishistic. It's like, whoa, apes and monkeys are extraordinarily similar to humans. Right, so they become a fetish animal. Let's see, anything else there? Oh, just at the end there, and they're talking about everyone has got fixations on snakes all over the world, including those really kind of prehistoric peoples in the southwestern United States, before there were Hopi and Navajos. There's the more ancient peoples like, Moki tribe that they're pointing out there. Notice also the other thing that we're getting more definitively now is the dual spiritism. See, it immediately gets brought into the fetish concept. Right? So some things are possessed by good spirits and some things are possessed by bad spirits. Obviously, initially, there wouldn't have been that before you had dual spiritism.
And the serpent in the Garden of Eden.
Right, and of course, not only do you have the apple being put into the Garden of Eden story, but you've got the serpent being put into the Garden of Eden story. See, both of those is because of fetishism. All right.
Certain days of the week became fetishes. For ages, Friday has been regarded as an unlucky day, and the number 13 as an evil numeral. The lucky numbers 3 and 7 came from later revelations. 4 was the lucky number of primitive man, and was derived from the early recognition of the 4 points of the compass. It was held unlucky to count cattle or other possessions. The ancients always opposed the taking of a census, numbering the people.
Yeah, so like the very ancient thing of the 4 points of the compass. Would you be surprised if I told you if that cubical building, or that square building, a Kaaba building, its corners are oriented to north, south, east, west? Of course you wouldn't be surprised, right? So they're just reminding you, it's like, why does it have 4 corners? What's so special about that? So that's because it's a very ancient lucky number, 4. You don't get 3 or 7 until you get some revelator bringing in 3 and 7 stuff.
four is very important to the American Indian
cult. Yeah. So it's very, you know, very general. But the striking thing, see, in this paragraph is, whoa, we went from the tangible to the intangible pretty quickly here. This is very, you know, we've taken this fetish concept to quite remote abstraction, days of the week and even numbers, you know. A particular numeral being possessed by an evil spirit, that's fairly abstract thinking. See, they're trying to point out, don't just think of it as a quote-unquote unlucky, you know, number. I mean, it's like, no, literally the number is being believed to be possessed. It's like, well, how could you think about that? It's like, well, no, think about it. It's not that bizarre. You're thinking that the spirit is an intangible fact, so why couldn't it possess an intangible fact? It's consistent. But it's getting very sophisticated here when you're starting to think literally about a day of the week or a numeral as being possessed by a spirit. Like I said up front, the fact that, and they're talking about this goes way, way back. It's such an early time. Even primitive humans were wrapping their minds around quite relatively abstract notions. This is an interesting little catalyst for the progress of abstract thinking in humanity. Sure, it's all superstitious, but it's actually getting the juices of abstract thinking going. And until you have significant abstract thinking ability, you can't have philosophic thought. So all this, again, the vast conspiracy of all this, right? How, this is a way that eventually, sows the seeds of a philosophic awakening on a planet. Then the other little thing, the whole bit about counting. And we all know about like censuses, even in Jesus' times with numbering the people and that sort of stuff. But just that abstract thing of counting, because you're thinking, in a sense, kind of literally about numerals and counting, if I count you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, now I possess you.
There's 8 of us.
Right? By counting, by numbering, right, you're taking possession, right? And it even gets you thinking, oh yeah, we call them possessions. Right? Because our spirit possesses them.
I'm possessed.
Yes. My possessions are possessed. The literalness of all this, just the way we talk about things. Remember how definitively they thought of your name as being one of your souls? For instance, they said, this is in the same league with that. This counting, this numbering phenomenon, right, is taking numbering and naming in a very serious, literal, spirit sort of a way. And as silly as that seems, again, it's fostering, searching for the spiritual or the soul very, very apart from matter. Right? Again, this process of abstraction can lead you eventually away, far enough away from matter that you might be able to imagine spirit existing fully apart from it. But you've got to be able to have some process of abstracting from matter, if you have any hope of getting there.
Yeah, when you count, you count material things.
Uh-huh.
Counting has to do with material. So,
but to abstract the counting from the objects that are being counted, See? Brings in this more sophisticated thing. And to abstract your name away from what's being named. And it's all part of that evolutionary process that eventually, you know, has a mind that can be taught to function philosophically. But until you get that mind away from being so simplistically identified with material objects, there's no hope. All right. Now, here's the tiny little paragraph. You know, whenever anyone today thinks of fetish, you know, we all know what pops into everyone's minds. You know, so there is a little paragraph dedicated to this issue.
Primitive man did not make an undue fetish out of sex. The reproductive function received only a limited amount of attention. The savage was natural-minded, not obscene or prurient.
Prurient, yes. right, not obscene or prurient. So very matter of fact about sex. You know, it's not until basically you get andite uplift that you inject this imaginative aspect into sex. You know, but they are reminding you. I mean, you know, we all know we use that sexual fetish. You know, we use the word fetish related to sexual issues today. You know, and it's because even though in some ways you were moving away from literal fetishes, mankind is steeped in this way of thinking. So he's going to effectively think that, you know, a sexual act is inspirited. You know, that you're by doing certain things, you're calling out of the ether some sort of greater energy that, you know, infuses the act. Like I said, several times tonight, it's like, well, the spirit of such and such. See, we talk about that all the time. I mean, even saying the spirit of intuition, spirit of understanding, the spirit of courage. Can you hear those designations, which are coming from the Old Testament? Can you hear those designations and help your, you know, avoid your natural tendency to actually hear that fetishistically? You know, even think about how many times the revelators say, okay, we're calling these things, you know, adjutant spirits or adjutant mind spirits, okay, but don't think fetishistically about it. Don't think of it as an entity that's, you know, even an entity that's possessing. It's a circuit. See, that's why they say that stuff so many times, because you can't help it. You're going to be thinking fetishistically when they use that terminology, and that's not appropriate. Don't think of yourself as being possessed by the third adjutant.
But my Ouija board said it was appropriate.
Okay? But if you listen to the way a lot of longtime Rancho Book readers interpret the adjutants, that's, you know, they don't interpret them as literally your mind. They interpret them as facts that possess your mind. They put new wine in old wineskins. They interpret them fetishistically. You know, and that's why a lot of people have attention when I talk about the adjutants. I seem to be debasing them, you know. Instead of talking about them as if they were spirits possessing me, I talk about them. No, they're just literally my mind. You know? You know, and I debase them by talking about mind energy instead of some woo-woo spirit that's possessing me. Yeah, that's because I'm not in the old wineskin of fetishism. I recognize what they really are. Okay, but not to belabor that, you know, for all of you, just double down. You know, now that I've kind of lifted that up in your mind, challenge yourself. Wait a minute, have I been kind of unwittingly thinking of them fetishistically? You know, it's like, maybe I have a little bit. I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going to try to focus in more precisely and not just kind of, you know, unconsciously roll with these things as much. All right, let's see.
I know we want to prurient.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, so obscene and prurient, you know, I think everyone knows basically what we mean by obscene, you know, is speaking of just the nature of a certain manifestation. Prurient is indicating, you know, like I, you know, saying that I have a prurient desire. So, I mean, that word is speaking to my inclination towards the obscene, mm-hmm. in contrast to that which is just obscene, and not talking about, you know, whether I'm inclined toward it or away from it, but just the fact of it.
A little bit unnatural.
You know, and obviously in both cases, you know, you use the word obscene or prurient because you want to indicate that there's a quote-unquote spirit to what's going on. It's energized more. You know, it's not just bounded a little ways away from treating sex in a matter-of-fact fashion, but injecting it with this spirit-like energy of thought. And of course, there's a validity to that. I mean, you know, an animal can't have concepts of obscenity or prurience. Right? I mean, it takes your greater energized, spiritualized mind as a human to get so intense and fixated on these things that you aggrandize them like this, you know, positively or negatively. You know, just you know, endow them with such intensity. You know, you don't want to just present. You want to present obscenely. See, you know, you're bringing that animation of mind that, you know, only comes from your human nature, you know, into your sense of it.
Yeah.
All in the mind, George. All right. So, yeah. So, but it's important. I'm glad you had me flesh those out a little bit, because I was kind of just assuming everyone was getting, you know, why this is in the midst, you know, why they're throwing those words out and talking about fetishes. See, you're literally, you know, bringing that kind of fetishistic, you know, infusion into the presentation or your desire, right? You know, you're prurient and you're possessed, mm-hmm. right? And that's the sense of how we've understood that behavior. That you know, that person is possessed in some way. And so, I mean, you know, in order to get away from fetishism, you know, you may want to actually coin new words in some cases, because the words we have are really based upon, you know, these old ways of understanding things.
Those words are possessed.
Yeah. Yeah.
New words in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what you're saying is, So your mind really comes along with the adjutant mind spirits. It's not like, you know, they are encircled in it to begin with, so to speak.
The adjutants are your mind, right?
Right. They're
not an addition to your mind. They literally are your mind. Yeah.
Well, and your mind's maybe more to it than that. I don't know, but.
No, I mean,
more things that work.
No, the thing about why it seems like there's a little more to it. Okay.
But I was going to come up with another.
Oh, okay, but let me just stress something that I didn't. Remember, there's two parts to mind.
Okay.
Usually when we talk about the adjutants, technically what we're talking about is the mind activity of a certain adjutant. And we don't, especially if you're talking about it as the spirit of something. And you are not highlighting the other part that's inescapably there with that mind activity, mind energy. Foundationally, each of those seven adjutants is a mind energy with a certain mind activity. Okay, that's, you could say, superimposed upon that, okay? And it's important sometimes. I mean, that's why I talk about the energy of instinct, the energy of rationalization, the energy of loyalty. That, just saying that is to get you to not just focus on sort of the high fancy activity, but the more foundational there, that's kind of just more intimately there because of the mind energy, the literalness of it. You know, you can even, if you speak a little less precisely, talk about the mind energy as being the substance, right, that underlies the mind activity, right? Even though you don't want to literally think of mind as a substance, matter and spirit are substances, okay. But see, that's very important. See, and that if you just focus on the activity, you would never think that my mind could be made out of the adjutants. But you're forgetting, they aren't just activities, right? They're literal energy. Now, the spirit of truth is, a ministry, an activity on a spirit substance substrate. And you're not really being engaged by the spirit substance underlying that. You're being engaged by the activity that's playing upon that substrate as the spirit of truth ministry. But don't think of the adjutants merely like that. Don't forget their substance, if you will, right? The literal energy that is molded into a mindal self. Remember, that's why they coined the word mindal in the book. They don't just use mental, because mental is kind of about the mind activity. Mm-hmm. Mindal, that coined word, is to remind you of the literal mind energy that's there. Okay. If you haven't forgotten.
Right. And you use you don't need your adjutants as much, especially when you get a Maharaja mind. It's not an adjutant.
Right.
It's a different point.
Yeah.
So what I'm talking about is trying to, the difference here, and they even say as you evolve as humans, you need use your adjutant spirits less because you've kind of gotten, I think, beyond them, so to speak, or the more you become orangely conscious or whatever, or what circle you come into, I don't really know. But when you get to mansion worlds, you have a totally different mind. Right. And it's not the same. And yet you still have thought, I'm sure. You still
right.
Who you are. You still have some references to a certain degree. You don't just go from here to something completely unknown because you have memory, etc. So that's the difference that, you still have mind. It's just, it's not adjutant mind. It's, right. It's, you know what I'm saying?
So yes.
It's a different basis, but it's still mind.
Right, so let's think about, okay.
So mind is more than just adjutant.
Yes, let's think about it a little bit more precisely. So, just adjutant mind, as basic adjutant mind, that's what we're analogizing is in the lower domain of the hourglass analogy. Okay? And that upper domain, that spiritualized mind, quote unquote, okay, there's literal mind energy that's up there. What you're thinking here is you take the literal mind energy that has seven phases to it in the lower domain and think about unitizing that, blending that together into basically one phase of mind in that upper domain. So there's the mind energy there is unified instead of in sevenfold like below. The mind energy in the upper domain is unified, but there's still a literal mind energy. It's a literal mindal self. But that fancier mind energy substrate allows for fancier mind activity to play upon it so that you can have these personalized activities up there. And that mind energy up there is midway between the agitant mind energy and the raw below and the mind energy of Marantia mind that is seated on your soul or, you know, that you'll have on the first mansion world. Right, so you on the first mansion world, you have a Marantia brain, right, that literal Marantia object soul, but then there's Marantia mind energy that is, you know, that rests gently upon that mechanism, okay? And then there's Marantia mind activity that plays upon that Marantia mind energy foundation. And that's an even higher mind energy. So the activity that can play upon it is even higher yet than what can go on in the upper domain of your hourglass right now. Matter of fact, it can play so high on that higher foundation up there that eventually what plays, the activity can take on this very holistic fashion of activity called moda. Okay? But higher or low, I mean, the highest, the consummator of universe destiny, okay, has a mind. He has a mindal self. There's literal mind energy resting gently upon some foundation underneath, and there's mind activity, right, playing upon that mind energy foundation. I mean, this is true. The universal father, right, has a, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter what being you talk about, right? They have a literal mind energy to their mindal self. When you talk about things like the universal father, the details get a little bit abstract. We won't go into the details right now, but just, you know, for the sake of argument right now, I mean, you know, in order to understand a being, no matter how high or low, start with this model. There's literal mind energy. There's mind activity upon that. You may have to think about the relationship between the mind energy, if you will, and the brain a little differently when you're talking about some high being than we're talking about us. Okay, maybe those two kind of are blended together, and the activity is sort of just as much upon that mind energy foundation, or just as much on the body as it is on that mind energy foundation. Okay, but details aside, you know, conceptually, right? If a being thinks, it needs effectively a mind energy and effectively a mind activity upon that foundation, or it doesn't think. And that's true, you know, it's true for a salamander, it's true for the consummator of universe destiny, and everything in between.
Like when they say, let us fashion man in our image, I mean,
right.
What image is it?
Right.
Mind.
Right.
So many people, you know, that you talk to, don't really understand the difference between there's actually mind versus brain.
Yeah.
It's like a concept that it takes a while for me to explain to them that, you know, your mind is different. You know? Your mind is something else. And it's kind of, you know, think of it almost as something in the spiritual realm or whatever, because it's not physical. And yet it works with it physical.
Yeah, see, and even you know, at the height of dualism, where you had mind and body, before everything kind of became philosophic materialism again, even then, they didn't have literally a mind-energy concept. They had brain and mind activity. They had mentality. See? And that's one of the reasons why it kind of evaporated and all. Because you didn't put some substance underneath that mentality. You need to literally recognize there's another energy apart from physical energy. Literal mind energy. Forget about mentality for a second. Forget about any thinking or anything. Right? There's just the stuff that a mind is made out of. Right? I mean, how could it logically, how could it think if it wasn't first a stuff? It has to be something before it can do something. Right? There has to be a literal stuff. Mind energy. Well, one of the past thinkers, you know, used the term mind stuff. Okay? There has to be a stuff. He was one of the fanciest thinkers ever. Stuff is the only word you can use. Okay? That's why I use it. Right? Right? There has to be a literal stuff. Okay? That's that mind energy. Your mind is literal. It's not literal if it's just a mentality. That's a magical notion. Okay? It has to be a literal stuff. Okay? That's the mind energy part.
Activity has which to be predicated on.
Yeah.
Originates from the third source and center.
Yeah. Which it literally is pulled out of the reservoir of the universal absolute, you know, and actualized. Just as there's a reservoir of potential that matter is actualized out of, the unqualified absolute, and a literal reservoir of potential that spirit is that stuff is actualized out of, the deity absolute. There's three reservoirs of potential, right? Now, three stuffs, and you get literal stuff. The third source and center becomes, as the absolute mind, becomes the anchor for that mind stuff, just like the aisle becomes the anchor for the matter stuff, you know, and the third and the second source and center as the absolute spirit becomes the anchor for the spirit stuff. Right? You have three absolute reservoirs of potential for the three stuffs, and three absolute anchors for the actuality of the three stuffs.
And the mother spirit is just a part of the infinite spirit, right? Actualizing that in our universe,
right? The spirit nature, you know, substance, and the mind substance of your stuff of the creative mother spirit, right? She just is in possession. Think about that in the way we're talking about here. She's in possession of measures of those two stuffs, you know, and it's her stuff. See, she literally possesses that mind stuff and that spirit stuff. Right? It's hers. And we are all just using her mind stuff and spirit stuff.
Crazy.
Now, until we are birthed out of that womb. Yeah. Yep.
Are you using the term stuff differently than you would use the term substance?
One of the handy things about stuff is, you know, it avoids the problems of calling mind energy a substance, right? If you call it a stuff. See, and you can even say there's deity stuff. That's what the capital D deity word means, right? It's, you know, the capital D thing is trying to remind you there's a yet another stuff, right? And you can make a body out of that kind of stuff, okay? Deity stuff. But you don't want to think of life animation or personality or pattern in general, pattern or animation as stuffs. You know, that's inappropriate to literalize them that much. You want to think in some very tenuous term like influence or something. I mean, the word pattern kind of helps you with that. For personality, spirit pattern. It's not a stuff. But matter, mind, and spirit, and deity are stuffs. Okay?
Weren't we always, or hadn't we designated those things, or like thingness, versus something that's not thing?
Yeah, right there, right there. Same. Yeah, I mean, and then there's sort of thing stuff, and then there's non-thing stuff.
Okay.
I mean, you can start to, you know, use the language to try to help, you know, illuminate this, but, right, but. Yeah, but see, the word stuff is a very handy general word.
Functional stuff?
Yeah.
Just goes great at Thanksgiving.
Yep.
Yeah.
Putting at the end and it's yummy. yep.
Chris, John Stevens is yep. asking, would you compare mind activity to mind function?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just you sort of, you know, you speak of the mind functioning kind of in a more general way where you're, you know, the mind energy and the mind activity are all together and you're speaking about the functioning of that mind. But if you want to get very precise, you know, set the word functioning aside. Or if you want, reduce it to two terms. There's the mind energy, and then there's the mind activity. And again, I'm not coining either of those terms. Those terms are given to us in the book, so that eventually when you want to talk specifically like this, you can. You know what term to use. But the handy thing about functioning is it's like set the science of mind aside where you're, these are scientific terms, mind energy, mind activity. Set the science aside and just think about it in general as functioning. And then you go, oh, mind functions, deity functions. Ooh, I bet there's a tight synchronization, immediacy between mind and deity. Yeah. It's you synchronize your mind to deity.
It's fascinating that we get more minds and that we get better minds.
The higher the mind, the higher it functions, the higher deity it can synchronize with.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of.
Yeah.
Only an infinite God would do that to us. You know? Get your mind out and bring it down.
And it's important because, see, what you really are is a mind. You're not a body or a spirit. You never will be. You'll always be a mind. And it's your mind that synchronizes with deity, whether it's the kind of deity called the Father or the kind of deity called the Mother.
Right? Even a six-stage finaler is a mind.
Right. Right. Yeah, they're using very high mind. We don't need to go into the details of what mind womb you're in. But yeah, there's a mindal self there. I mean, you know, You don't even remotely begin to go beyond just your mind synchronizing with Father Deity until you make that journey from the third circuit of Avona to the aisle. And at that point, you have your first recognition that goes beyond just mind synchronizing with his deity. You have your first personality recognition, see, which is technically getting that, you know, your personality, which is a spirit pattern, that's, you know, sort of that observer point above your mindal self, right? You're getting that, see, effectively spirit-based recognition to the Father's personality. Everything else is not a spirit, quote unquote, recognition. It's a mind synchronization. The functioning of your mind synchronizes with the functioning of Father type deity. And that's fundamentally what you're doing. Now, your mind can't function like that if you're not a personality. Okay, but it's It's not technically a personality recognition. When you get up to the sixth level of meaning, you're talking about God knowingness, or even way transcendent of that, where you might use this term God consciousness. That's not personality recognition. Right? Even though you're saying, well, isn't God personalized deities? Yeah, but it's actually deity knowingness. Your mind is synchronizing with the deity of the Father. And that's why, for the advanced student, you'll notice how many times in part four, it doesn't say the universal Father, it just says the Father. See, which is technically, it's trying to remind you. What Jesus is encouraging you to seek is a synchronization with Father deity, not a personality recognition. That's impossible. So he wouldn't encourage you to do it delusionally, right? It's impossible until that journey from the third circuit of Avona to have any personality recognition of the Father. You're having a deity recognition. And don't worry, that's plenty. Okay?
You won't be disappointed.
Right. The deity functioning of an adjuster, you know, it's a deity fragment, is so fancy. The only terms they can think of to use for its functioning are personal terms, like will and love and things, right? So you're not going to feel shortchanged by feeling the deity functioning of the Father apart from a direct personality recognition. Don't worry about it. It's really cool, right? It's so much beyond anything that you think of with the word personality right now anyway. Okay. Yeah, the very fact you don't have a personality recognition of the Father until that third circuit, you know, visit should remind you that maybe you don't know what the word personality really is referring to. Okay. It's a rather transcendent fact.
What a ways to go.
Yeah, you might want to just, you know, avoid being too delusional about that right now. Okay. Your mindful self is really cool. Okay. Just let the personality thing be doing its unconscious benefit to you. And do like they say, the whole journey up to the local universe, that's all you're focusing on, is getting a mind that functions in a symmetric enough way and in a an expansive enough way that it can seriously synchronize with deity, right? And see that, you know, it's your relationship to Mother deity, which is imminent, that is the immediate fostering of that better functioning of mind, not the on the outside transcendent Father deity, right? But the inside imminent Mother deity.
Another,
right?
The hat to deity.
Again, the mother influence dominates the human personality throughout the local universe, childhood of the growing soul. You know, just another way of saying what I'm just saying. Okay. But just to appreciate, see, that's something that's never been presented to us till the fifth epical revelation. Deity and mind, that this is the key thing. You know, and to challenge yourself to not try to transcend mind, because you're just going to end up going off on a fanatic tangent. The mind doesn't need to be transcended. It's way cool. Get comfortable in it. Take delight in cultivating its higher functioning. You'll be delighted with what results from that. The more that mind synchronizes with deity and you benefit from that. All right. Meanwhile, back to the literalness of fetishes. So what else besides going off on these abstractions, what more literal things are humans fetishizing here?
Saliva was a potential fetish.
No, a potent
fetish. Potent.
Far from potential.
Yeah.
It was thought very literally. Yeah.
Devils could be driven out by spitting on a person. For an elder or superior to spit on one was the highest compliment. Parts of the human body were looked upon as potential fetishes, particularly the hair and nails. The long, growing fingernails of the chiefs were highly prized, and the trimmings thereof were a powerful fetish. Belief in skull fetishes accounts for much of later-day headhunting. The umbilical cord was a highly prized fetish. Even today, it is so regarded in Africa. Mankind's first toy was a preserved umbilical cord. Set with pearls, as was often done, it was man's first necklace.
That kind of gets us back out of the the ethereal clouds, doesn't it?
Very grounded.
Well, I'm just not feeling very refined right now. I don't know about you. Yeah, we start out pretty coarse. Mom kept it and made it into a necklace for me. Well, actually, first she made it into a toy, and then he made it into a necklace. I kind of didn't highlight it. One, three paragraphs back. Remember when we were talking about milk and excreta with cows? Recognize that we still have to think about honorable belief here in the midst of talking about excreta and umbilical cords. The key is, milk wasn't just magical, or, cow urine wasn't just magical, right? It was literally possessed by a spirit, and hence was potent, right? That's what they're thinking, just how strong cow urine smells would be proof of its spirit possession and potency. For instance, it's the way they're going to be thinking. And of course, we already read about blood, like being literally the soul, say. So, of course, the umbilical cord thing is right. You can literally see how it's possessed by a spirit because you see the blood. Right? Who can deny it? To like cow's milk, to think, so when you see someone in India spooning milk, to a statue, you're thinking, they think they're feeding their god. Why would gods, eat, these molecules in milk? It's like, no, that's not what they're thinking. They're feeding the spirit in the milk to the spirit god. They're not silly, right? They know if you're going to feed a spirit, you got to feed it with spirit.
Didn't we get the sense that, by contrast, the things that we, the degradation of considering magic, probably not very honorable by comparison.
Yeah, I mean, the skeptical individual, during and post, the years of the Enlightenment, has forgotten to think about this in an honorable way, right? And they just dismiss and denigrate these people, superstitious fools. It's like, no, don't judge it by its surface, right? There's something, there's the beginnings of something sophisticated. That poor primitive person, down in southern India that's spooning the milk into that statue has a more sophisticated worldview than you, five PhD scientist, that believes that everything is all matter, which is absurd. That's much more absurd than thinking you're feeding spirit through milk to a spirit being inside that statue. That's much less absurd than believing that all there is matter. And then believing that all there is that matter magically came out of nothing in a big bang. Seriously? Let's go with this feeding milk to the statue. That's much more grounded in reality.
That's what primitive, and then there's pre-primitive.
Right. I mean, the statue feeding is only primitive. Right. The believer in the Big Bang is a pre-primitive. Completely absurd. Utterly illogical. Right? At least there's some logic. That's what's head, you know, see, you know, between the lines, they're trying to get you to recognize that. Who's the fool here? It's that guy who's an Oxford PhD, not that primitive in southern India. Unfortunately. And if Oxford produces pre-primitives, yeah, I think there's probably an interregnum coming.
Publish it.
Honored for it, and let's see, anything else there? Oh, just of course we all remember how Jesus was playing into the spit thing, when he's
spittle in the eye.
But again, just to what he was acting out there. What the people watching, they didn't believe that the spit was curing. It was the spirit in the spit that was curing. And a holy man like Jesus obviously can endow spittle with spirit. And of course, everyone knows the long-growing fingernails thing, like the Asians, with their massive curling fingernails and stuff.
This is a bridge too far. An elder or superior spits on one as a high compliment.
I'm gonna start that moray up again. I'm sure you'll all be delighted. So you want to be able to unpack the revelation, huh? I need to endow you with the spirit of unpacking.
Initiation.
Wait for it.
All right. If I spoke in Klingon, you'd naturally kind of spit when you speak in Klingon, and then you would all be endowed with the spirit of unpacking. All right, anyway, back to being serious here. Again, remember, just the point of emphasizing all this is just to get you to focus specifically and not just think about all this stuff as mere magical, right? There's a, there's a so-called science to a lot of this stuff, and we still speak. I mean, the reason that we think we're saying something non-woo-woo when we say, well, the spirit of the law. Right, we don't think that we're just being some completely diffused superstitious person when we talk about that. The letter of the law, the spirit of the law. Right, I mean, we use those expressions still, even though we don't literally think of law fetishistically, because there's a precision to it, because of the science of fetishism. Okay, that's why we continue to use it.
There's truth for us too.
Yeah, there's a truth to the precision. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going.
Hunchbacked and crippled children were regarded as fetishes. Lunatics were believed to be moonstruck. Primitive man could not distinguish between genius and insanity. Idiots were either beaten to death or revered as fetish personalities. Hysteria increasingly confirmed the popular belief in witchcraft. Epileptics often were priests and medicine men. Drunkenness was looked upon as a form of spirit possession. When a savage went on a spree, he put a leaf in his hair for the purpose of disavowing responsibility for his acts. Poisons and intoxicants became fetishes. They were deemed to be possessed.
again, you know, the devil made me do it.
Yeah.
Right? Sort of thinking. But they were, you know, they weren't just, you know, being clever here. No, they literally thought, it's like, no, I literally can't be held responsible for my actions here. I am possessed. Right? Not figuratively, literally. Right? And we all know that, you know, we've got shades of this all the time. Innocent by reason of insanity, for instance. All right? He was possessed. So again, even if you can say, well, yeah, but that's not just arbitrary. I mean, there's some validity to that. Yeah, but how did we get to that? Yep. Right? It's through fetishism. And a lot of it is just this sort of a posteriori reasoning. We go, well, no, actually, I look at it. You know, that particular medicine that they believed was effective just because of fetishism actually, molecularly, does have some benefit. Or, you know, all these various things that we re-examine, and even though they might have gotten into play because of fetishism, you know, it's not always just arbitrary. Okay. As a matter of fact, that, you know, the longer the fetishistic notion lasted, the more likely it isn't just arbitrary. There's probably actually something genuinely there, in one way or another.
There's an on-ramp
there. Yeah. So we progress in spite of ourselves. And of course, you know, everyone knows the obvious. I'm still calling, you know, alcohol spirits. But again, you know, this is just to remind you. No. They literally thought there was a spirit being in that bottle of whiskey.
I like the leaf in the hair.
Yeah, the leaf in the hair, yes. Yeah. Oh.
Anybody seen my leaf?
Yeah. You go, well, why a leaf? Oh, I'm possessed by a nature spirit. See my leaf?
On my way to the bar.
Here's
my leaf.
All right. One last little paragraph here.
Many people looked upon geniuses as fetish personalities possessed by a wise spirit. And these talented humans soon learned to resort to fraud and trickery for the advancement of their selfish interests. A fetish man was thought to be more than human. He was divine, even infallible. Thus did chiefs, kings, priests, prophets, and church rulers eventually wield great power and exercise unbounded authority.
Everyone knows an individual that's rather popular, that's spoke of enough as being infallible. Right? The vicar of Christ. The Pope. Right? But you may have not thought for a while anyway about... No, think about that literally. He's literally possessed by the Spirit of Christ.
Good.
Right. You know, and that in the early days, they were thinking of that very much fetishistically. He was a fetish individual.
Yeah.
Okay. Things about laying on hands and things like that. I mean, you are literally transferring a spirit. You know. So, you know, we forget about, you know, the reason that people still take this stuff seriously is because in the past it was thought of very literally. So inescapably it was taken seriously. Right? I mean, the table's literal, so you take it seriously. If it falls on your foot, you know, it's going to hurt. Right? So because of fetishism, these things were thought of very literally, so they were taken very seriously. And you know, here they're focusing on the positive side, the wise spirit, you know, the geniuses, etc. But you know, notice up there one of the things I didn't bring out in the preceding paragraph: primitive man could not distinguish between genius and insanity. There's something between the lines there that's very important. We bring it up all the time, the double-edged sword. Okay. Don't ever forget that when you initially begin to have some of that higher recognition that your spiritualized mind allows for, you cannot tell the difference between 0 degrees and 180 degrees. Right, your initial coarse recognition only is aware of whether or not you're aligned, not whether you're what direction you're aligned. It's subtler to distinguish between true and false. You know it's reality, but you don't know if it's true or false reality. You know it's liberty, but you don't know if it's true or false liberty. Okay? Because you can't initially. Your mind isn't refined enough for that subtler distinction. It's like subtle, it's 180 degrees. Okay? Yeah, well, that's the way we visualize it, right? But it's actually a very subtle thing that you're analogizing as 180 degrees difference. So, you know, that bit, you know, that's the degree to which you are still, in effect, primitive when you can't distinguish between true and false liberty. Or you take something super serious and you're not just zealous, you're fanatical. Because now you've added this realityizing to your zealotry with your third cosmic intuition. And it's like, no, this is real. It is the way it feels to you. And that's why you're all the more intense about it. Yeah, but that's false reality. Yeah, you take a hold of that third cosmic intuition influence on your mind. See, now you hold reality in your hands, right? Yeah. Is it solid, you know, in a true sense or a false sense? It's in your hands. But it will have that solidity of reality feeling that you will have added to your mind.
Often yeah. Fanatics are lacking humor.
Yes, you know, obviously the more intense you get, it's like, no, there's no place for humor here. This is real. Right? See, yeah, as I said, it's been given this greater degree of literalness, definitiveness, prickliness, even you might say, sharpness, right? That literally drives all the humor out of them. It's like, dude, lighten up. Right? You're way too pokey. It's like, well, no, it's not me. It is pokey. It's reality. See, that's the way it feels to them. And they're the author of that. Because you have free will in the upper domain. You know, truth of influence from the three cosmic intuitions is not automatic. That's in your hands. So, all right. Well, let's see. Yeah, maybe we have time for getting a little bit into this. Well, or what do you think? It's kind of late. Let's not get into it. Let's just flesh out this a little bit more. And that we would be pushing it too much. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the things I kind of skipped over with these last two paragraphs. That you know, all that stuff about hunchbacked and crippled and you know, lunatics and hysteria and idiots, you know, and all this. You know, notice the way they kind of brought it out in that final. Hysteria increasingly confirmed the popular belief in witchcraft. You can start with the assumption that a woman is a fetish individual, that she's possessed by an evil spirit, and hence a witch. You know, maybe just start there. It's like, oh, I never thought about it so literally. Well, you don't really appreciate what the word witch means then. And it isn't just a magic woman. It's a woman who's possessed by an evil spirit. Okay. So it's no longer in her hands. She should have a leaf in her hair. Okay. And this whole bit of confirmation bias, as it's usually spoken of, as you know, or as you hear me say, confirmations don't prove anything. Right? You can confirm true and false theories. Right? And we saw this a little bit before, like when they were batting, you know, just the basic issue of fetishism against reincarnation. You know, and they seem to be mutually validating. See, they're bringing some of that up again. You know, the very fact that the woman believes she's literally possessed by a spirit, so she doesn't have any control over her mind. See, she'll be unwittingly letting go more of her mind. So don't be surprised if she's more inclined to hysteria, an uncontrolled manifestation of her mind. And see, like you're saying, that just increasingly confirmed. You know, we see this all the time. I mean, you when you definitively believe something, consecrate yourself to something, you set up this negative feedback loop, as it were, right, that reinforces this. You know, you can take something that maybe is a degree of an Achilles heel in an individual, you know, the very fact that a guy in general likes to go be along a line, you know, think of hysteria. You have to sort of like de-line yourself, right? And you're just, you know, this randomly directed thing. You know, you lose all linearity and rationality. Well, I mean, it's obviously going to be, in general, more straightforward for a woman who isn't so inclined to be a line but a circle, right, to go into that mental state. Right? You know, and so it just, you know, coincidentally just feeds in that kind of Achilles heel to validating, quote-unquote, confirming, sure enough, she's possessed by an evil spirit, because everyone knows that extraordinary mind is spirit by definition. Okay. And hysteria is not ordinary. So all these issues, and you know, especially when it goes beyond the immediate things like hunchback and crippled and right, that kind of extraordinary relative to the body is going to be all the more powerful when it's removed from the body and is of the mind, to being thought of as the fact of spirit. Okay. And as I said up front, I mean, do you really think of spirit as a third fact relative to matter and mind? Or do you think of spirit as extraordinary mind? If so, you're fetishistic. Okay? You know, we talked about being in the ghost cult framework, you know, and not getting outside of that old wineskin. And this is also part of it. You know, are you in the fetishism framework and don't recognize it, and just how difficult it is to not be in that old wineskin when you read spirit of intuition, spirit of understanding, spirit of courage, spirit of knowledge, etc. You're going to think in the old wineskin of fetishism about that. And you're going to have to really challenge yourself to not think of it like that. Those adjuncts aren't possessing you. They are you. It's like, well, yeah, but they're the creative mother spirit's adjuncts. Yeah, your mind is on loan from God. You're just borrowing your mind old self. And guess what? You'll always be borrowing a mind old self. You'll always be in a mind womb where it's really the possession of a mother, not your possession, really. Huh. Well, that gives me a humbling sense of self. You're always going to be dependent.
So if there is no spirit of evil, like, and then they say about how God can't really experience that which really doesn't exist, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Why is it that pretty much everybody looks at these evil spirits that way as opposed to positive side of things, even today?
Yeah.
You know, when you look at it, most people talk about that as being a negative versus a positive. And maybe it's just the fact that it's the animal part coming up. Fear, maybe, is, you know, the animal fear and so on and so forth. And then, you know, it's got to be evil spirits. But I think it's, if you know what I'm saying, I mean, it, because really isn't any, there is no spirit of evil, so to speak.
Right. Again, it's that very, you know, the core of that, what you're talking about is it's very difficult for us to not believe what we project, right? It appears that there are objective evil spirits, if you will, you know, that there's evil stuff in the external world. But not, really, you know. It's in us. There, you know, there's subjective evil spirits, if you will, but not objective evil spirits. I mean, even Lucifer, you know, is still a subjective fact. You know, he hasn't somehow taken over reality and made it so now there actually is black stuff and white stuff. No, there really is only white stuff. In the same way that he can project that out there, you can imagine that he projects it out there and now his black ooze is afoot in the universe. Not really.
Well, when you give evil form in your mind...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when you get badness form in your mind as evil, right? Evil is when you give badness form in your mind. See, that's what I'm saying. It's subjectively there.
It's a subjective
fact
that you're giving form.
Yeah.
Plenty vivid.
Right, but there's no absolute anchor to sustain it. Right? You know, the absolute dimension of your personality sustains it, see? In relative terms.
But just to make sure, you better take the stuff out of the vacuum cleaner and make yourself a smoothie. Just quaff that. It's okay.
Yeah, like they said, some really obnoxious, you know, like synagogue sweepings, you know, temple sweepings or whatever. Yeah.
Mix that up.
Right, it's got the spirit of the temple and the sweepings, and that will, you know, get to the heart of the matter. Yep. Yes. Again, see, obviously, all those sorts of notions are fetishistic thinking. You know, and to not think of it as magic temple dust, right? But to think of the way they thought of it—that there's literally a spirit in that dust that has the power to plumb the depths of the individual and
expose
the reality of it.
Because I belong to a church, occasionally these things come up. One is the laying on of hands
right.
when there's new group of elders. So anyone who has been an elder is supposed to go up and lay hands on them. And it's kind of interesting because I don't think there's any real memory or understanding associated with this.
Right.
But because it's such an ancient practice, there's a sense of sacredness.
Yes, obviously, see, it's sacredness, of spirit possession to it, yes. Yeah, and you know, just to wrap it up, I mean, I think probably a lot of you are aware that, you know, that issue of whether or not, you know, you're validly a priest if you aren't part of the long line of succession of laying on of hands, I mean, you know, we get pretty close to going to war over that still. Right? You know, Jesus laid his hands on Peter, Peter laid his hands on, right? You know, so, you know, you're passing the Spirit of God through the individuals by, you know, and if you just randomly come out of nowhere and declare yourself to be a priest, no, you're not a valid priest, right? The Spirit is not in you. You know, they will argue.
Here come the sweepings.
It's like, well, you know, couldn't the one that is part of the laying on of the hands, couldn't he just wash his feet in some water and sprinkle it a little bit, and then we can move on to the next topic? It's again, you know, the arbitrariness of these. You know, there's a science, quote unquote, to this stuff, but it's like the science in Harry Potter. You know, it's like, well, okay, so why can you do that, but you can't do that? Well, because that's the science of it. You know, it's the same way with these things, right? There's certain things that are valid and certain things that aren't. But like we were seeing tonight, that that actually is moving somewhere. At least you're starting to think in terms of what you how you eventually need to think to be a scientist, a genuine scientist, right? Where there's just laws and that's the way it is. You know, and as a scientist, you really can't address the question of, well, why is the law this and not that? It's just the law, right? If you're going to address the question of why the law is this and not that, that's going above science to philosophy. So this, you know, the scientist and the religionist have to just, they just sort of take laws at face value.
That's the law given.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll get in, you know, more into the evolution of the fetish here next time. I'm glad we actually went quite a bit over just talking a little bit more. You know, just remind you, you know, we could talk, you know, for 2 hours about every paragraph if we wanted to. I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff that you can talk about in these paragraphs. So, you know, we're not going to do that. So you do that yourself. Remember, you know, don't just wait for every Friday to roll around for me to jiggle air molecules. You spend some time reflecting and see what other things you can recognize through the suggestions of the revelators. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.